It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with fantasy author Sarah Prineas. Her latest book for middle grade readers, The Lost Books, came out this summer, and it launches an exciting new series. But first, as the flu season is getting started for this year, we're going to take a look back 100 years at one of the worst pandemics in human history. The flu of 1918 took an estimated 50 million lives worldwide, 675,000 of them in the United States, about 6,000 in Iowa. Michael Lueck-Troms is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture. He's been traveling the Midwest over the past few weeks, sharing what he's learned about this devastating period in our history, and he is here with me now. Hello, Michael.
Good morning, Nebbe.
Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Now, we are used to living in a global culture today with people and diseases quickly making their way around the world. We were not as connected back in 1918. So what do we know about where that influenza epidemic began and how it traveled?
I'm so glad to be here this morning. There are actually several misnomers that we need to nip in the bud right away. It should have been called actually the Kansan flu, because all epidemiological research indicates it began actually in Kansas in the late winter, early spring of 1918, not in Spain.
We call it the Spanish flu.
Right, which is totally inaccurate. Just briefly, the reason that people called it the Spanish flu then was that all the other major Western powers were involved in World War I. Spain was not. So even though their king, Alfonso XIII, was sick as well, and a third of all of Spain got the flu and 10% of them died, it actually began here in the Midwest, as best as we can tell. So it really should be called the Kansan flu.
All right. How did it travel? I mean, we know that it took so many lives around the world. If it started in Kansas, how did it get everywhere?
Well, the second sort of misconception we need to also nip in the bud. Certainly today we're very connected globally through jet engines and all the things that bring people together quickly these days, autobahns in this country, interstates. And yet in 1918, the world wasn't quite as disconnected as we might think. The locomotives were spreading their railroad nets throughout the entire world, South America, Africa, Australia. And then you had World War I. So you had literally millions of young men, tens of millions of young men and their attendant nurses and doctors and support people moving around the world. The British Empire sucked all these young people, not just out of Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Southern Africa to Europe to fight in that war, but also they brought non-white colonials from Equatorial Africa, from India. So you had literally all these people moving around, and because the virus had mutated and was especially wicked to people aged 20 to 35, soldiers were among those who suffered the most, as were minors, students, Hollywood crowd. Perhaps we'll get to that later, but at least 12 major silent film stars, actors, producers, directors all died of the flu, as did many stage people, writers around the world. So it was young people who got devastated by this.
What did we understand about the flu in 1918? I mean, when people started getting sick in large numbers, what did we know about trying to control this?
We knew far too little. For one thing, microscopes in 1918 weren't really able to detect viruses. They were able to detect bacteria. So when the flu, long story very short, started in the Midwest, went to Europe in spring of 1918, came back in September through Boston, they were looking for bacteria, and they were looking for the wrong thing. So while the medical doctors, especially the army doctors, were trying to find out what's causing all of our soldiers to get sick and over 10% of them to die, they kept looking for the wrong thing. And they tried vaccines, which were totally useless against a virus. It was this virus that left them in the dark. So they tried to stop it with mask. Well, mask will stop perhaps bacteria, but masks are not, the warp and the weave are not tight enough to stop viruses. So almost everything they tried as a firewall against it didn't work.
The flu wasn't new. I mean, it had been around, just not at this level before.
Indeed, there had been waves of outbreaks of rather nasty flu, 1890s and in the past before. Many of the people who'd been alive in the 1890s had some immune resistance to the strain that came through in 1918, 1919. However, all those young people, many of them hadn't been around in that period, 20, 30 years earlier. When people ask me, you know, where did it really come from, it's hard to pinpoint it. It's not like with HIV where they found a patient zero. There's strong evidence that actually it would have perhaps begun in China. There were indications of flu in 1916, 1917. The Allied forces contracted Chinese laborers who were sent from China to Vancouver and then across Canada in trains. Unfortunately, the Canadians locked these boxcars and these trains that carry these Chinese workers who were getting sick and clawing at the door and pleading to be released. They were literally among the dead. So those trains of the dead arrived in east coast of Canada probably fall of 17, and there's great speculation that that virus then was distributed to the soldiers as well. So, I mean, it's just a perfect storm for a disaster.
And that's why young people were so vulnerable. They just did not have the kind of immunity that older people of older generations might have built up over time.
Yes, and your listeners can actually view the slideshow about this at traces.org. In the slideshow, I begin in March of 1918 at Fort Riley, Kansas. It was a support branch of that camp, Camp Funston, that had the army mules and horses, some swine and poultry to feed the soldiers. And it's speculated there was a huge dust storm on one weekend in March. And they think that in the dung of the service animals for the soldiers, this strain might have been incubating. Anyway, it jumped to the soldiers, most likely. On Monday, the 11th of March, one of the soldiers came in at about breakfast time, a cook no less, and he complained of achy joints and fever. And by noon, there were 100 soldiers, and by the week's end, 500. And again, 10% of these men died. When that virus was sent out, medical doctors said, you know, you shouldn't send these soldiers to the front. You need to quarantine them and just wait on this. Of course, the government didn't listen. They sent soldiers from Fort Riley to Camp or Fort Snelling in St. Paul. Many people in Minnesota got sick. They sent them also to the East Coast and to Europe. When our soldiers got to Europe, then the virus was in our barracks and was also soon on the German side, in the German barracks. And they followed the disease and the outbreaks enough to know that that virus is the one that probably got on ships, supply ships, again, the British colonies, down to Equatorial Africa, to Sierra Leone and other places. It mutated, and the virus returned through Brest, probably, port of northwest France. And in September of 1918, it's when hell really broke loose, and you had really biblical suffering. The first place in the United States to really come down with this was Camp Devens outside of Boston. And the men were falling ill so rapidly, so many of them, that they had to park men in the hallways of the camp hospital. Later, they had to put them in the canteens, the mess halls, the free time spaces and the gyms. And then it went to the general population.
And it traveled then back to where it started.
Yes, yes. And I think it's really important to note, because I think, Charity, you're interested in, you know, could this happen again and how could we prevent it? One of the things that didn't happen is the military echelon wasn't listening to its own army doctors. And the army doctors said, you know, you've got to slow down the moving of troops. You've got to break up these large crowds. And of course, the demands of the war, we thought we almost had the Germans beat. The army was trying to speed up things, move more men. They had more recruits. The draft was still training conscripts. And so this was, again, a perfect storm. One good example is in Philadelphia, they had 1,500 cases of people dead from the flu already by September 28th of 1918. And the army doctors said, don't do this. And despite that, the city officials had a fourth Liberty Loan drive. 200,000 Philadelphians appeared on that Saturday, lined the streets. French troops were marched to show our allies. They had a special plane that flew overhead. And within 3 days, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of Philadelphians fell ill. If you look at that PowerPoint presentation on our website, you actually see a chart from the period. Philadelphia had the highest death rate. It was fantastic. Literally, they had no coffins after a certain point. They had no more wood to build coffins. They were putting the dead on porches, and death wagons, like in the Middle Ages, would go up and down the streets collecting the corpses. They had so many people die so quickly, they ran out of grave diggers. So they had to have, steam shovels, where they would literally dig long trenches, and we have photos of the mass graves in Philadelphia and in Vermont, other places. And they even had the priest shorten the last rites and the services at the grave. They couldn't keep up with it.
Wow. As the pandemic really took hold and people were dying at such massive numbers, I mean, do we know, do we have an idea of what the percentage of people who fell ill, what percentage died?
It tended to be at least 10%. Again, this prime age range from 20 to 35 was hit the hardest. Most flus take down little kids, older folks, the pregnant, those chronically ill with rheumatism, or these days people with HIV, others. In the 1918 wave, it literally was taking healthy people. And I don't mean to be unnecessarily graphic or sensationalist, but in a nutshell, what happened was these young people, their bodies, mostly fit immune systems, were so adamant at fighting this invasive virus that the body began to transport all these white blood cells. And literally, Charity, the people were drowning in their own lungs. Our slideshow opens with an army autopsy. And when they would saw open the chest of the dead soldiers to find out what this was, it would burst open and there'd be all these fluids. One of the problems they had, for example, returning to Philadelphia, the morgues were overstacked. And they had the problem that all these fluids and things were spreading the disease further. I mean,
they couldn't contain them.
No, and it's a perfect storm. So it just kept spreading.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Iowa historian Michael Lewick-Troms. He is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture. He's been traveling the Midwest over the past few weeks, sharing what he's learned about the devastating pandemic in 1918, the influenza pandemic that he was just sharing with us began actually in Kansas, not in Spain. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. If you have family stories about this time, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with fantasy author Sarah Prineas. Her latest book for middle grade readers is called The Lost Books, and it came out just this summer, launching a new series. Right now, we're talking about the flu pandemic, the influenza pandemic of 1918, estimated to kill 50 million people worldwide, 675,000 in the United States, about 6,000 people in Iowa. With me today, Michael Lewick-Troms. He is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture. He's been traveling the Midwest over the past few weeks, sharing what he knows about this flu pandemic. And Michael, let's talk about the flu pandemic coming to Iowa. We've got a headline from the Des Moines Register that from October 10th, 1918, Des Moines goes under quarantine today. Tell me about the flu hitting Iowa.
Indeed. The state was not prepared for this. At first, in college towns like Iowa City and Grinnell, local mayors and others tried to take some measures, and then finally the state stepped in and made statewide policies and bans. For example, in Grinnell, the students continued to go to classes. They were not allowed to, quote, go into town, which if you know Grinnell, it's sort of silly because the college is across the street from residential houses in the town. In Iowa City, it's actually a tale of misery. One of the things on the PowerPoint presentation that your listeners can view very easily, we have a rolling death toll from the Iowa City Citizen, I guess then it was called the Citizen, not the Press Citizen. It starts in October 3rd and it goes through October 30th. And at first, the daily death toll is relatively small, 1, 5, 11, and then it jumps. And you have every day 69 people have died. At one point, it's 239 people have died. We have stories there and in the local press, the documents from the period, like in Cedar Rapids, whole families dying, children dying, parents dying, leaving children. A lot of orphans were created. When you get to places like Iowa State College, now Iowa State University, my alma mater, they also took the gym, made it into a makeshift hospital, which became for many a death site. So the toll in Iowa, much like across the country, was among young people. I should add, by the way, it's really hard to get numbers tacked down because of record keeping, the period, plus just the loss of records over time. The Cedar Rapids Gazette once put out an article a few years ago. They estimated over 6,000, I think 6,600 people died, they said. The Iowa Historical Society, which may have more accurate numbers, I'm not sure, they have an exhibit at the moment in their museum downtown Des Moines. And Leo Landis's exhibit, I think he's the one who curated it, talks of over 7,500 Iowans died in that period. What's noteworthy is that if it was as high as 7,500, if I read correctly, 700 soldiers alone at Camp Dodge near Johnston fell to the flu. I mean, 700 dead soldiers. One of the reasons, Charity, that I'm taking this topic on the road is that if you had any commensurate disaster like that today, not 7,000 Iowans, but 700, if they were to die of a natural gas explosion or a terrorist attack, it would be major news for weeks. And yet by the summer of 1919, if you read the papers, read the magazines, listen to the people's stories, it was as if this pandemic had not happened. So one of the things that interests me as a social historian, what are the mechanisms through which a family, a community, a nation can have such a horrific experience and within a few months, a very short time later, basically airbrush it from their collective memory?
Yeah, why do you think that happened?
Well, we have to look at the larger context. The war, World War I, was almost over, officially the 11th of November, and the disease was still raging, but it was slowing down by early November. So the people worldwide were weary of all the death. In Europe, 16 million people died of the war. I should note that most nations outside of Germany lost more to the flu than they did from soldiers falling in battle.
Right. You just said 16 million people died in the war. 50 million people died
of the flu. Yeah. And again, one of the reasons that I scratch my head and I give this program everywhere, I'll be most of the next week in Southeast Iowa, is, you know, why, given the size of this disaster, there's no commensurate collective memory. Every little village in Britain, France, Germany has a monument in the village square to World War I, later, unfortunately, with a plaque. Oh, and by the way, in World War II, we lost these boys as well. But nowhere do you find plaques about this pandemic. I ask the audience often, why do you think this is? And people scratch their heads as well. It was a different time. I would propose that perhaps people were encouraged not to bring up, quote, unpleasant things. We know that our parents and grandparents were less likely to talk about alcoholism or abuse, substance abuse or incest or homosexuality, things that were taboo. I suppose that similarly, this very uncomfortable specter of death was also sort of suppressed. But the consequences are grave because I don't think we're prepared for another similar pandemic.
We are going to go to the phones here. You're welcome to join our conversation. If you have family stories that have been passed down from this time, we'd love to hear them. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. With me is Michael Lewick Trams. He is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture. And Ruth is on the line from Lidderdale. Hi, Ruth.
Hello, Charity.
Hi, thank you so much for calling. And you have a family story about this.
I do. My family has been very good at preserving all kinds of letters and family artifacts. And among those is a 1919 letter from a relative of my mother's who lived near Casey, Iowa, on a farm. And in the letter, she describes how she would go from farm place to farm place, nursing all these sick families. And the death toll, like a mother would die in the morning, and by noon her baby would be dead. And one farm she went to, all the members of the family were in bed except for a six-year-old girl trying to take care of the whole family. So she just went from farm to farm doing this. Then in between, she would go home and try to keep up her duties at home. Like, for instance, I think it mentions butchering a hog. So she was just a phenomenal person, kind of a Florence Nightingale of Casey, Iowa.
Yeah, fascinating. And she didn't get sick.
She did not get sick, no.
That's amazing. And Michael, are you hearing a lot of stories like Ruth's?
Yes, and I will say that, like with our other speaking tours or formerly the bus tours, at every venue where I tell these stories, every time someone comes up silently afterwards and says, well, you know, actually my Aunt Martha fell of the flu, or my grandfather got sick after his wife gave birth to their child, and therefore dad grew up without. I mean, we hear these stories all the time. What strikes me is, why aren't these people's stories better recorded? I don't think there's any shame involved, but why aren't these getting preserved for the future? This is part of my mission, is to save these fading stories from forgetfulness. Everyone has them. They just don't talk about them very much.
Well, and so if Ruth wants to make sure that this story gets recorded, Michael, how do people do that? How do people get in touch with you and make sure their stories get told?
I would encourage people to go to our website, traces.org, www.traces.org. They can contact me or my interns. We always have some young college interns doing this, or some of our volunteers or board members. We'd be thrilled to either print out what they send us, our email address is there, but we are still collecting these stories. There is a chance still the rest of this week people can rush to Southeast Iowa to see the actual shows that I'm going to be doing in mostly libraries, schools, museums. They can go to our website and watch the videos that we've made on the PowerPoint. There are actually two about the what we call the killer, the flu pandemic. The first is, where did the virus come from as far as epidemiologists can tell today? What was its impact? How did it spread? But part two is really a digital memorial to all those people who had the flu and survived, and many more who had the flu and died. If I can just take a moment to mention who had the flu, survived it, but were never the same. Woodrow Wilson, the president, had the flu, and even though he didn't die of it directly, it's said that he was later laid lame by his weakened state. The King of England, George V, had the flu. As I mentioned, the King of Portugal. Many royalty, the Kaiser, had the flu. Mahatma Gandhi had the flu and almost died from it. He had returned from his 20-some years in South Africa and was back in India, where 20 million people died of the flu. So there are all these people who had it, Greta Garbo, Lillian Gish, other notable people, writers, athletes. But then there are many more people that we know about who's not discussed, who had it and died. Many Hollywood ascending stars, producers, directors. Hollywood was devastated, as was the stage in New York and in France. Many French actors and actresses, again, Charity, these are young people, and they're being wiped out in one big swath.
Did that make that part of it? And Ruth, thank you so much for your call. It sounds like your aunt was an incredible inspiration to you as well. Did the fact that so many people were dying in entertainment, on the stage, in the movies, did that lead to any superstition about this disease and maybe the theater?
Not that I know of. What is remarkable is the only piece of literary work that I know of, and others have also said to me this is the only one they know of, was a book, Pale Rider, Pale Ghost, or something like this, Pale Horse. It's the story by Catherine Porter, a writer of that period. She had gotten the flu in Denver. Her soldier lover took care of her. She survived, but he got it from her, and he died. It's the only literary work that I know of. There's so many. Georgia O'Keeffe had the flu and survived. We have pictures of her before she was sick and after. She was transformed by this experience. Look at, again, the photos on our slideshow or her art. So this flu played a role in people's lives, but later they rarely talked about it as if that flu was the engine behind their changes, but it impacted lives all over the place.
Well, and it's fascinating to think of the people who were lost and the impact those individuals might have had on our culture.
We should mention that at least two heads of state were taken down by the flu. Brazil's president reelect got the flu and died before he could take office again, vis-a-vis the election, was it this weekend, of Brazil's new head of state. And in South Africa, Louis Botha, who'd been a Boer guerrilla during the Boer War with England and had taken Churchill hostage as he was a young reporter and would-be politician in South Africa at the time. By 1918, Botha was in the government in Pretoria. He was the premier, and he died of the flu. So you have countries becoming heads of stateless. You have places like China, 10 million dead. Russia, a third of a million during the Bolshevik Revolution. Mexico lost a million people, just those who died during the Mexican Civil War. So you have this, again, perfect storm of not just epidemiology and those conditions, but politics. In South Africa, which lost half a million, and in India, as I said, 20 million, the ANC, the African National Congress, and the INC, the Indian National Congress, in their respective countries, both got huge jumpstarts, lots of social capital, because the British, or if you will, in South Africa, the whites, did almost nothing for the indigenous population of color. And so the ANC and the INC rose up, and they distributed food or blankets or tried to send healthcare workers. And this actually led to more liberation movement, that they would get rid of the English. Those are important things. And in South Africa, the whites began to say that black Africans were spreading the disease through their hygienic conditions. And this is what they began, the pass laws, that blacks now had to show a little booklet saying that they were healthy and disease-free to be allowed into white areas to be nurses and maids and others. So this is the early beginnings of the pass law under apartheid, this flu. There are a lot of implications that we don't know about, but the modern world was in part created by this experience. This collective global experience changed the world forever.
It's fascinating. When you talk about this not being well recorded or well remembered, it strikes me that maybe one of the reasons was that we really didn't understand what had happened. We didn't have the scientific knowledge to understand what had happened, or even maybe the communication to understand how many people were lost.
Yes, I think you're right.
I want to read you an email that was just sent to us from Charles in Bettendorf. He says, my mother was born in October of 1918 in Waterloo. She was born on her mother's kitchen table. I've always thought she was born at home because of the epidemic. Is there truth to that assumption?
And that could be well be, of course, going to a hospital or army medical center would be really risky business. I would like to say, I don't know the case in Davenport Bettendorf's story, but I would like to enter this sort of branch topic. Those deaths in utero, the fetuses who were being carried at the time who were lost when their mothers died, they've done studies that those people who survived the flu but were being carried in the womb in the fall of 1918, they did studies over several decades. I don't mean to be provocative, but statistically, this group performed less well than those before the pandemic and those born afterwards who weren't in the womb. And in terms of career, income, all sorts of measures, those who were in the womb and experienced the flu in utero and didn't die were handicapped. If not physically, they were handicapped maybe mentally or in other ways. So this flu had a huge impact even on the unborn, and many pregnant women lost their lives and took their babies with them, many of them.
The world has changed dramatically since 1918. We have a much stronger understanding of how viruses spread, better ways of treating them, better ways of preventing them. As we mark this centennial, what do you think we need to learn from this pandemic and what we know?
Unfortunately, we humans are still humans with all of our foibles and tendencies. A good parallel would be the HIV/AIDS pandemic. One of the reasons that finding not a cure, but firewall against the spread of HIV, or at least treating those who have it, was the competition between, for example, French doctors and American doctors. There have been films made that if these people had not been on their ego trips trying to be the one who discovered the source of HIV, people who had the virus or had AIDS as a disease would have been helped earlier. We do know that in the 1918 pandemic, there were also medical well-known personages who were competing to crack this code on that disease. If these people would cooperate more and compete less, it would help the world. And as you say, I've said many times, we're more technologically savvy. We have better medical equipment. And yet my fear is that the biggest detriment to stopping something like this happening again isn't so much medical knowledge, it's the political structures that break down during a crisis where people have turfs to defend, they have careers to advance. That is almost as bad as the lack of medical knowledge.
When people come to your talks, when they learn about this history, what do you want them to walk away with?
I want them to have more information about what happened. Relatively, most of us know very little about this. Many don't even know what happened. And again, Charity, commensurate to the number lost, I would propose we do not have enough memorials. We don't have enough retrospective or introspective perspectives on this. You know, what happened? Could it happen again? If so, how could we prevent it? Because it's been allowed to fade into forgottenness in our collective memory, it makes us more damned to relive it. So I'm hoping that people will come, they will listen, they will share, and leave more informed to all of our programs.
Michael, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Lewick-Troms is the director of the Traces Center for History and Culture. You can find out more information about the flu pandemic and the events where Michael is speaking to people, sharing this information on the website, traces.org. And coming up in just a moment, I'll be talking with fantasy author Sarah Prineas. Her latest book is called The Lost Books. It just came out this summer. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.